Welcome, everybody. It's great to see all of you here this afternoon. We're going to do a round of applause already. Okay, Tom Harriman wants to start by applauding. It's really my pleasure to get this wonderful celebration kicked off by introducing our Chancellor, Henry Yang. Henry has, as all of you know, been a stalwart supporter of the KITP. He actively recruited me and David and Leon and I think everybody here, and was just here yesterday to meet with the staff at the KITP. And for those of you who don't know, Henry's other day job or night job is helping to get a 30-meter telescope built in the state of Hawaii. And he will blame me for all of his efforts there because he asked me if he should do it and I said yes. So I really do want to thank Pat Zurdiaga for your contribution to the KITP. It's a wonderful gift that you and Joe did for the Institute, and I think you're going to hear more of that thanks as the evening goes by. But I really just want to acknowledge that right away. So with no further ado, Henry, I'm going to hand it over to you. You can use this one if you wish.
I can use this one, yeah. Well, I thought it was going to be a reception, then we just go to the podium and everybody talk stories, but now it's so formal, so I have to make my presentation a little bit formal. And I, you know, it's always the happiest thing for me is to attend those ceremonies to celebrate accomplishment of our university, our colleagues, and celebrate especially at KITP. KITP seems to have always endless things to celebrate because of your wonderful accomplishment, especially during this house, and it's best time to choose for us to celebrate. And I'm so pleased to see Pat here today. And whenever I see you or I don't see you, I always remember Joe. Joe was such a dear friend. I still remember the first time when I met Joe was actually through the introduction of the physics department chair, Mark Schrenicki. I don't know if Mark happens to be old Mark. You knew him from way back during your department chair days. You were kind of fearless, just go to him, ask for scholarships. And because at that time he already established graduate fellowships for chemistry, biochemistry, biology, molecular and cellular biology, those areas. But how could he ignore physics, right? So you went to him and he added a physics fellowship to among his things to be funded. Then I started to talk to him. And I thought it would be a good idea to establish an endowed chair. I think, I don't know if our science dean is here today. So we talked to him, and I also talked to him, and he said, I would like to establish an endowed chair. But when I establish an endowed chair, I don't want it to be attached with those presidential chairs, somebody matching. No, I don't want it. I just want to be all by myself. And I also think your endowed chair, the number is too low. So he keep adding it first, $500,000, $1 million, $1.5 million, keep adding. Then he said, I said, who would you like to be the first? He said, the first one wanted to be another Joe. Oh, you're here. Yeah, another Joe. At that time, you were just making a headline about your experiment about Higgs boson. And he knew your work. He also liked your first name. And I remember at a home for the celebration dinner at the night, you met Pat for the first time. And you said something so sweet. You said, Pat reminds you of your mother. And I remember then Joe told me, he said, Pat actually support this. He said, I can do more. I remember that night. It was so important. He wants everything he does, he always think of Pat. He wants to make sure Pat is on board. So he said, Pat really supporting this. So I feel so good. So we had that endowed chair. That was quite an event. Then it comes to another Joe Puchinski. So has the right first name also. So we were talking about, then he had an interview lunch with Joe and Dorothy Dillon. We were there at that time. And Pat, you were there. And I still remember that conversation. Joe was asking me, what is a string theory? And he pulled out his string of his keychain. He said, "Does that relate to that string?" He was kind of joking. But I said, if anybody can explain string theory to a person who is not a physicist, I think Joe would be the best. But if you want to know the real depth of that, you want to know mathematical theory behind that, the theoretical physics behind it, you got to ask our Nobel laureate here. But I don't think you have explained the string theory to Joe Isardiaga. But Joe did, and Joe Puchinsky did it, and he explained to him, and he really liked Joe Puchinsky. Then Joe took the endowed chair. But unfortunately, Joe is not able to be with us today. But I also wanted to acknowledge Joe's last year. Exactly this time, Joe went to San Francisco, received that Milner's Breakthrough Prize. That was a big prize. That was a big prize in fundamental physics. So now we are so honored, so pleased that we are able to have our next chairholder, Leon Valence, to be here today. And I just wanted to say Joe was such a wonderful, wonderful friend and a strong supporter of UCSB. Before that, before I met him, he supported UCLA quite a bit. And but after I talked to him, he started to really fell in love with our physics department. He supported this department so strongly. And I just every time when I think of Joe, I just think how fortunate he realized the excellence of this campus. He appreciated physics, and he supported us so strongly. And we will remember him forever. And tonight we're going to remember him again to have a celebration dinner. Just we assume he's always with us, Pat. And we also wanted to thank Pat for all your support over the years and your support of Joe. And you are so special. You don't like recognition, but whenever we say we want to recognize Joe, you know you come. So we will keep honoring Joe to make sure you come, so we can also honor you to show our appreciation to you as well. Thank you. All right.
Where Leon actually gets to sit in his chair. So we have two chairs here. So Pat, you get to sit in one. Leon, you get to sit in the other. Sorry, Pat, nobody warned you, did they? Henry, you need to be up here so we can... You get to pick. Henry. Sure. All right, I'm just going to say a few words to introduce Leon. So all of you are going to hear the science he's doing. And what I wanted to comment on more is Leon as a colleague, which is a fantastic colleague. Everything we do here at KITP requires all of our faculty to be fully engaged in everything going on. And that is what Leon does, not only mentoring his students and postdocs, but being fully engaged in our programs. So as all of you know, and many of you are here as program visitors, many of us get pretty engaged in ensuring we get the right people here. So if you're here, you should be flattered. Ensuring as well that the programs maintain a high level of activity throughout that whole period. And that is something that Leon really excels at. And I just want to sort of acknowledge that, because that is a large part of what we do here at the KITP. So with no further ado, Leon, I know you're eager to get going. And so I'm going to hand it over to you. Leon.
Yep. Let's see. Ah, it's working. Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for being here, and thanks especially to the Zerdiaga family, Pat, for showing up and for being so generous and enabling this event. I'm going to try to keep you entertained a little bit. Let's see, this should do it. Okay. I could not have gotten here today without many people's help, and I especially want to thank my family for encouraging me in science, and my father and mother early on. My father actually passed away last year, but my mother's here now, and my daughter and wife more recently have been very encouraging. I have to say my mom is more of an art person than a science one, so Mom, I hope you'll bear with me. There's so many other people I'd like to thank, but if I did that individually, there'd be no time for a talk. But let me just say, I want to thank the KITP faculty and staff as well, and our strong community supporters. I'm very sorry Joe Polchinski, the former chair holder, couldn't be here. He's a fantastic physicist and remarkable human being, and we're all thinking of him. I'd like to thank my friends and colleagues in the UCSB Physics and Materials departments, and also many, many past and present students, postdocs, and faculty visitors. I'm going to try and highlight some of their contributions through the talk. So this is a talk about magnetism. I love magnetism. Everyone's probably played with a pair of magnets as a kid. You can feel that mysterious force between them. It's like you can feel magic with your own hands. It's a little glimpse into this usually hidden world that's somehow behind our own. Magnetism was known long ago in ancient times, in ancient Greece, India, and China. This is a model of a compass, ancient Chinese compass called a Sinan. These ancient magnets were found naturally as occurring natural rocks called lodestones. They're made of the mineral magnetite. But magnets have all sorts of applications. All electric motors use magnetism or magnets in some form. Cordless tools, for example, use permanent magnets like the lodestone. They're essential components of computer hard disks. That's a little drive that cost me, I think, about $60 to save a terabyte. They're pretty amazing. If you listen to music, you're using permanent magnets in your speakers. And some applications are just for fun. Over the years, I felt like there must be some magnet here at UCSB that keeps attracting me back. This is kind of my career trajectory. I made a couple of attempts to go back to the East Coast, and it never took. So you may wonder, you know, why are magnets magnetic? Where does it come from? Well, Carl Sagan famously said, "We are made of star stuff." That may be true, but everything, including star stuff, is made of magnets. So that the mystery is not so much why are some things magnetic, is why is not everything magnetic. So you all know matter is made of atoms. An atom is like a tiny solar system. It's got a nucleus and electrons orbiting around it like planets around the sun. Those electrons are actually tiny magnets. An electron is like a little bar magnet. You can think of it as a little spinning charge, and the physicists know that a spinning charge makes a magnetic field, so it's like a tiny electromagnet. Physicists call this magnetism spin. And instead of drawing the bar magnet, we like to draw an arrow that goes from the South Pole to the North Pole. You can think of each little electron in an atom as being a spin like this. And in a material like lodestone, which is an actual macroscopic magnet, these spins are aligned. So they all point in the same direction. That's what the physicists call it, a ferromagnet. And your own experience tells you that ferromagnets are not that common. Most rocks are not magnetic. Most things around you are not. So if everything's made of magnets, why isn't it? Well, it's because these little spins, these little magnets, can do other things. A very common thing for them to do is align in some alternating pattern. This is what's called an antiferromagnet. So some spins are up, some spins are down. The net magnetic field from all these spins cancels, so they don't appear like a magnet to you macroscopically. Amazingly, antiferromagnets are much, much, much more common than ferromagnets. Some huge fraction of minerals are naturally antiferromagnetic, but it's not so obvious because they don't stick to your refrigerator. It was actually only in 1949 that antiferromagnetism was really proven to exist. And it was proven because of the development of the experimental technique of neutron scattering. And so physicists had to produce neutrons to do that. So they had to invent reactors or particle accelerators as a source for neutrons. It took a surprisingly long time for the Nobel Prize to be awarded for this, but in 1994 the Nobel Prize was awarded for the discovery of antiferromagnetism by neutron scattering. Antiferromagnets actually come in a huge variety of forms. It's not just a simple up, down, up, down, up, down pattern. There are all sorts of other patterns like they're shown here. And understanding what occurs in nature and how it occurs is kind of a tempting problem for a theorist like myself. Okay. So you might think of it's a bit like working on a jigsaw puzzle. You're given a box with the puzzle pieces, and you try to figure out how they are put together to produce this work of art that you see. Like Starry Night here is partly solved. So I'd like to give you an example. Usually we talk about very old things in these type of public talks. I'll tell you something really current, actually something that we're finishing right up right now. We haven't even written the paper yet. So Lucille here, let's see if my little thing works, yeah. She was a graduate student here, UCSB alum, actually that's her picture doing the commencement speech in 3 years ago at the grad commencement. She was a postdoc until this last summer at MIT, and these are two experimentalists at MIT. And Joe and Takehito had done some exciting experiment, and they brought them to her. What they did was they measured the resistivity of some crystals. That's a kind of ugly example of a crystal here. They apply a magnetic field to it, and they measured how the resistance across this crystal as they rotate the magnetic field. And what they saw was this surprising fact that the resistance has these very sharp peaks, very, very sharp as a function of angle. We think this might eventually be the sharpest angular signal dependent resistance on magnetic field of any known material. So there's the puzzle. This is the outcome. How do these little electron spins in the material end up leading to this? So together, and with the help of Jianpeng Liu, who's one of our postdocs up here, we figured out that this behavior comes from a particular spin structure in this material. It's what I've shown here. The spins actually on these cerium atoms in the structure, they form some particular funny arrangement that I don't really expect you to understand. Physicists, my colleagues in the ringers in the audience would appreciate that this is a domain wall. This is related to domain wall resistance. But I'd like to point out that this work was really possible because we had all these nice facilities here at KITP for visitors. I actually used a little bit of the Izurdiaga funds to support Lucille's visit here in August. That's the time that we were able to work all this out with the help of John Pung, who's one of our excellent postdocs. So that's antiferromagnetism, and as interesting as it is, it's not the end of the story. There's more, because electrons are quantum spins. So the rest of today's story is about quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics is amazing. Physicists love it. But it's hard for me to explain to you just how exciting it is. I think I'll let the noted physicist Sheldon Cooper speak for me instead.
Quantum physics makes me so happy. Yeah, I'm glad. It's like looking at the universe naked.
Well, it's hard to follow that. So let me explain a little bit about quantum physics. So to explain it, we need two spins. There's a phenomena which goes at the heart of quantum mechanics called entanglement. And traditionally, when we start talking about quantum physics, we introduce two actors, Alice and Bob, here. And suppose each of them have one electron, one spin. If they're opposite, like in an antiferromagnet, there's no net magnetic moment, so they would look from the outside like some non-magnetic combination. So Alice's could be up and Bob's could be down. But equally well, Alice's could be down and Bob's could be up. This is where quantum mechanics gets weird. In quantum mechanics, both can be true. Actually, the spin can be up and down, or down and up. It can be both at the same time. We say in quantum mechanics that the state of the system is up, down, plus down, up. This is what's called an entangled pair of spins. In principle, Alice and Bob can take their spins with them far away. They could leave this room and one of them go to South America and one of them go to Africa. Halfway across the world, they can still have this entangled state. This is called, the separated pair of spins is called an Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen pair. What's weird about this is that the state of either spin is completely undetermined. It's equally probable that the Alice's spin is up or down. We have no information about it. And the state of Bob's spin is also completely undetermined. But there is some information in the state. If Alice's spin is up, Bob's must be down, and vice versa. You can ask the question, as Einstein did at the time, where is this information stored physically? And the answer is it's not stored with either Alice or Bob. It's stored somewhere completely different. This is what's called quantum non-locality. The information about the state of a physical system is not anywhere in specific point in space. And Einstein really didn't like this. This is for my mom's benefit. I put this in here. He called it spukhafte Fernwirkung. My mother's German, so she'd like to hear a little bit of the native language. It means a spooky action at a distance. Einstein didn't like it, but we know it's true. Actually, there have been a number of experiments over time, starting with the brilliant ideas of John Bell, actually proving this experimentally. And this is some example of early data proving this, in that this is really true, using photons, not electrons. And actually, it's a practical thing. People are increasingly using entangled pairs of photons for the purpose of encryption. Using this and some other tricks, you can take advantage of this and send a completely secure signal. So how does this connect back to electrons and solids? Well, the fact is that nature actually forms these EPR pairs, these entangled spins, very commonly in atoms and molecules. So the simplest example is just a helium atom. It's the second lightest element. It has two electrons on it. In its ground state, the typical state of a helium atom, those two electrons are actually form an entangled pair. Okay. Now this is hard to take advantage of, even though it's present everywhere in nature in helium gas, because those two entangled electrons are very close to one another. It's hard to separate them. They're bound to the atom. But there's a long series of ideas that led to how these electrons might be actually separated. And the genesis of the idea actually comes from chemistry. Physicists tend not to like anything from chemistry, but this is an example where they really contributed to us. Linus Pauling developed the theory of what he called resonance in chemistry. He was interested in describing structures like the benzene molecule here. A chemist might draw the structure of benzene like this with this kind of circular ring. He thought of it as resonating, sort of changing between this pattern of single bonds and double bonds and the opposite pattern of single bonds and double bonds. But this chemical bond is actually nothing but an EPR pair of electrons, an entangled pair of electrons, and the resonance is just this quantum superposition of different states. So because these pairs of entangled electrons actually change in the different parts of the superposition, the entanglement is sort of extended further and transferred farther away. Now we have a potential for utilizing it. So fast forward a few decades, and Phil Anderson, a towering figure in physics, suggested that Pauling's idea of resonance might be extended beyond a small molecule like benzene, but to a whole actual macroscopic piece of material. So you can imagine putting each electron into an entangled pair with, for example, its neighbor. There are many, many, many of these EPR pairs, but now considering all possible places these go, and imagine the system is in all of these many, many states at once. So this is what he called a resonating valence bond state. So this RVB, or he also called it a quantum spin liquid state, is really a massively entangled state. If you try and really write all the terms, the typical physicist shorthand, we write dot, dot, dot here, which means I didn't write everything. I left off almost all the terms. If we had even just 500 spins there, much less than you'd have in any visible chunk of material, there'd be more terms in this sum than there are atoms in the visible universe. So this is really a massively entangled state. So you might think of this quantum spin liquid or RVB state as kind of a baby cousin of another very famous entangled state, something called the Schrodinger cat. This is actually drawn by Megan here. There was this famous thought experiment where one notices that in quantum mechanics it's possible to have, at least physics allows, for there to be a quantum superposition of a macroscopic object to different realities, such as, for example, a live cat and a dead cat. That is really a massively entangled state, but it's a very difficult one to achieve in practice. This spin liquid or resonating valence bond state of Anderson's is a much, almost as entangled, not as entangled as that, but actually something much better, easier to achieve in practice, so you can think of it as maybe a Schrodinger kitten. And you know, kittens rarely come alone. They travel in large litters. And as physicists have come to appreciate over the past decade, so do these exotic quantum states, quantum spin liquids and other remarkable things. So we can imagine, physicists believe, that there are whole families of these strange states of matter, strange stuff. What do they look like? Well, here are some examples. These are different materials. This is a mineral known as Herbert Smithite, after a mineralogist, Herbert Smith, who discovered it. This doesn't have a name, but ytterbium magnesium gallium O4, synthesized a couple years ago. And bismuth selenide is actually a material that's been fairly commonly used as a thermoelectric, but recently realized to be more quantum. So you look at these things, and you know, if you, from your point of view in the audience, they look maybe shiny. They don't look especially quantum. So these have been known, the first and third have been known for decades at least, but not really recognized for their quantum nature. So you may wonder, how do you detect it, and if it's so hard to see, is it useful for anything? So physicists are thinking about these questions. They're working on how to observe the weirdness of such quantum matter. One thing that we know is that this strange stuff like this behaves as though it contains unusual particles inside it. These physicists call them quasi-particles. It's going to be hard for me to actually explain it. I'll just give you an example, and you'll have to trust me. So I showed you this cartoon. This is just a three-dimensional drawing of a piece of the wave function of Anderson's RVB state in which all the electrons are paired up. But you can imagine pulling one electron out of a pair and pairing up all the rest. This extra electron is sitting somewhere, and it has an unpaired spin, so it has a little magnetism. It's like a tiny magnetic moment. This is something called a spin-on. It actually behaves inside the spin liquid like a particle that has a magnetic moment like an electron, but no charge. It actually can move around as an electrically neutral particle. We don't know what these spin-ons are useful for, but we can imagine, for example, a new class of materials that conduct heat the way a metal does. You know, copper is very good for cooking because it's a good metal is a very good conductor of heat, but which are electrically insulating. They may exhibit very strong sensitivity to magnetic fields. Other exotic materials like this, not exactly this one, may be useful for more exotic applications, for example, like quantum computing. So these same ideas may have fundamental applications. And we can ask a more ambitious question: could the elementary particles and forces of our world emerge from entanglement? So let's consider electromagnetism. We understand a lot about it. Back in the 18th century, Charles-Augustin de Coulomb discovered the law governing the forces between electrical charges. and between magnetic poles. You probably learned that in high school, maybe. In 1861, James Maxwell gave a complete classical description of electromagnetism and discovered that when you put electricity and magnetism together, out of it emerges a wave, and that wave is exactly the light that we see illuminating this talk, among other things. In 1905, Einstein wrote a famous paper explaining the photoelectric effect, which is what solar cells are based on, that shows that light is strangely not made up of waves, but made up of photons, which behave as particles. So physicists had a hard time kind of reconciling this. This is maybe one explanation. You can count it both as a wave and a particle for tax purposes. In the end, we understand this, what's called wave-particle duality, because of quantum superposition. Light is really carried by photons, which behave like particles, but statistically, their probabilities of doing things are described by a wave. So by now, we have a complete quantum theory of electromagnetism, except for one thing. We don't know why it exists. We don't know where it comes from. I've been lucky enough to benefit from UCSB and the KITP environments in many ways, and strangely, out of the study of minerals, can come ideas for fundamental science like this. Back in 2003, Mike Hermely was a graduate student here, and Matthew Fisher, who had a permanent member position here at KITP at that time, realized that a certain spin liquid on this funny lattice, we made a nice model of it, would actually do this. And inside the spin liquid, it would behave, for all practical purposes, as though there was artificial light propagating around. It could emerge out of the electron spins. Move forward a few years. In 2011, we realized that our purely theoretical work might actually apply to a specific set of materials, including this one, ytterbium titanate. This is a rod of it grown by a chemist. These are collectively called quantum spin ice. We worked hard and were able to make some pretty nice comparisons between theory and experiment. And if you look at these plots up here, the top row are some experimental observations and the bottom is data. And to my eye, they look pretty darn similar. It stimulated kind of a boom in the study of these quantum spin ice systems. And in the bottom right is a very recent measurement. I won't really try to explain it, but the experimentalists who are publishing this paper argue that this bottom peak here is actually a signature of this artificial photon inside this material. We could get more ambitious. We could try to explain gravity. Being at KITP, you see a lot of wonderful talks with high-quality graphics, like this one I took from a KITP Blackboard lunch by Mark van Ramsdonk a few years ago. He points out that gravity is like a square peg in a round hole. There's no theory of quantum gravity. Figuring out where gravity comes from is a lot more challenging than understanding where electromagnetism might come from. And one reason is that Einstein told us that gravity is not really a force, it's the shape of space-time. So if we want to understand where gravity comes from, we're actually trying to understand where does space-time come from. That's not easy. Well, if a rock, a mineral like this, could lead us to some ideas for the origin of light, could something else, equally mundane, lead us to somewhere to suggest the foundations of gravity? It may seem far-fetched, but there's something called a quantum dot, not quite as mundane as a rock, but an artificial structure that many physicists and engineers produce in their laboratory. So a small chunk of metal atoms could be a kind of first step in understanding a quantum theory of gravity. You might think this sounds completely crazy. In a quantum dot, you have electrons. We're concerned with electrons. These are very tiny light things. Gravity is mostly interested in huge exotic objects like black holes. I'm sure you all heard about the black holes discovered by LIGO recently. They were enormous objects. To dramatize it here, I've written out the mass of electron in kilograms. Okay, if you understand the notation, it's 0.000009 here kilograms. Very, very tiny thing, electron. You're made of a lot of them. The black holes observed by LIGO had a mass of approximately 6 with a whole bunch of zeros here kilograms. They seem completely different, but I discovered a hidden relationship. So that cannot be coincidence. There may be a deeper relationship. So 2 years ago, Alexei Kataev suggested that studying a particular system of electrons, this quantum dot I mentioned, exerting strong forces on one another, might actually lead to gravity. This is kind of a cartoon of it. So at least gravity in what's called two-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. It's not our gravity, it's not our world, but the idea is being actively pursued to see if it might lead somewhere closer to reality. Here's a picture from Alexei's talk in April 2015. And I want to just point this out as another example of the KITP leading in science. Kataev is a remarkable genius. He's created several fields, in fact, but famously does not write his results quickly. And it's actually through the online access to this talk that most of the work following up on Kataev's brilliant idea has occurred. It's probably one of the most accessed videos in the KITP's massive archive of scientific talks. The field has grown so much that there will be an entire KITP program on the physics emerging from this idea about a year from now, the fall of 2018. So in physics, we try to be flexible. I'm almost wrapping up if you're worried I'm going on forever. With Zhuoyang Song, a young lady up here, and Chaoming Zhang, who's one of our postdocs, Zhuoyang was an undergraduate visitor, we recently took these ideas and sort of reversed it. We asked, rather than trying to understand gravity, could we use these weird gravitational objects to understand something back in my world of materials and electrons? And we had the idea that using a lattice of these strange black hole-like objects, that's the picture on your program, we could understand the unusual metallic properties of seemingly ordinary materials. And this will be a subject in this program next year. So I think I've spent enough time keeping you from celebrating, but I really appreciate it, you coming here to celebrate this with me. And once again, Pat, for enabling all this. It's really a remarkable gift.
Now, as all of you know, the tradition here is time for questions. So, I will bring the mic to you. Nobody was ready. Here we go.
You mentioned this this resistivity, if I understood, as a function of, was it a magnetic field?
It's an angle of magnetic field.
But, yeah. And you said that this is to do with some domain walls. Can you say what phase are you talking about here? What is the phase of the antiferromagnet?
Okay, this is definitely a ringer in the audience here. But, just briefly, there's a in physicist language, there is an Ising broken symmetry. There's a canting of these spins, which can cant. They can, the field is in some direction. They can cant either to the right or to the left. And there are domains in which one domain it cants to the right and one domain cants to the left. And those domain walls, they actually only occur. They're only stable for one specific direction of field. Then you get a domain mosaic. If you tilt away, you destabilize one set of domains, principle instantaneously. As the cleaner you make the material, the narrower this range will happen.
I just want to know if I've understood the analogy to gravity. Does it mean that you've come up with an interaction based in magnetism that's strictly attractive, doesn't have any repulsive side to it?
You shouldn't think about no. It's really a very amazing thing. So it's a kind of example of a duality which the people working in quantum gravity and string theory talk about a lot. The model that Kataev talks about, this quantum dot, is really, it's like a big atom. There is no dimensionality to it at all. And they're actually random interactions, some repulsive, some attractive. But out of it emerges, at low energy, something that looks like gravity in a higher dimensional space. It's really an amazing thing. But that's the level of thing that has to happen in a full quantum theory of gravity. So the quantum side doesn't look much like gravity at all.
Leon, let me ask a question. So when I see all these unusual materials, I always ask, how did the chemist or the physicist or the material scientist find it or make it or dream it up? Or is it coming from theory, or are they in the lab doing stoichiometry?
It's a combination of these things. I mean, I think there's an art to the people who do this material synthesis. But they're somewhat guided by theory. So there's a class of these materials, for example, the one I showed you, this one with the angular dependent resistivity that we're finishing now. There had been some theoretical calculations suggesting that this thing would have what are called Weyl fermions. They were done for a whole set of different materials. These guys are experts in low temperature transport measurement. They were looking for that. Actually, we don't think the phenomena really has anything to do with that. So it's very important to have this kind of back and forth between experiment and theory.
Thank you for the great talk. So I wonder, for the pair of entangled photons, how do they distinguish their partner from the third photon or other photons?
Right. I think maybe you're asking, for the pair of entangled photons, what's the correspondence between the spin states? So that the photon has a certain polarization it can have. It can have a helicity. Photons come in two helicity states. Basically, we know the photon is a propagating electromagnetic wave, comes out of that. The kind of orientation of that with respect to the propagation direction defines the helicity. It's maybe a little bit technical, but a photon has a sort of internal quantum number, like an electron has spin. It's called helicity. And you measure it with polarizers.
Is there a range that beyond which they cannot see each other anymore?
So the entanglement doesn't really have to do with seeing each other. If you ask, how do you determine whether they're entangled or not, you have to do simultaneous measurements of both, and correlate the measurements. So eventually, the photons don't have to interact with one another other than to produce the entanglement. But eventually, you have to measure both and then bring your measurements together to compare them. So the human involved in the experiment has to come, the two humans, Alice and Bob, have to later meet or exchange information, something, for you to tell that they were entangled.
Thank you.
Since bioscience is very dependent upon the resolution of MRI, and MRI is dependent upon the magnets, can you talk a little bit about the future improvements in MRI because of magnetic advances?
I think I can't talk very intelligently about that, I would say. Typically MRIs use electromagnets. I think issues in MRIs are simply mostly related to the large size of the magnets and the cost of maintaining magnetic field for so long. So lower resistance materials, superconducting magnets are just becoming practical. For some MRI applications. Certainly a holy grail for many theorists like myself who work on materials would be to discover a room temperature superconductor. If we could do that, we could have many applications like much, much lower cost, better MRI machines. That's been a goal for decades. Everyone has their opinion on how achievable that is.
I read recently that the Chinese are developing a more secure system of communications using entanglement.
So I mentioned there were many of these companies, actually. So there are quite a few companies that are doing secure communications. Basically, it's called quantum cryptography, which use entangled photon pairs. So what Chinese have done, some transmission of entangled photon pairs over very long distances using a satellite, bouncing light off a satellite. That's probably not practical for most of us to use. I imagine it would be very expensive. I recently saw headlines that someone has managed to increase the efficiency of this type of technique to be able to encrypt on the fly an audio signal. It for some applications is already worthwhile, like communications between banks on some dedicated fiber optic line. It's going to probably be very specialized applications, at least in the short term, that uses quantum cryptography. But,
Okay, well, thank you so much, Leon. So I welcome all of you to join us in the courtyard for a reception, so you can continue to become entangled.